Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
With Rod Oram this morning. Kia ora, Rod. How are you?
I'm Marina Rachel. Very well, thank you.
Gosh, it is all kicking off in the UK. 38 ministers and aides have left now. Boris Johnson's government resigned, basically, because of his sort of, I guess, covering up, you could say. What's the situation going on? I'm going to leave it to you as the expert to maybe explain what's happening here. But it is all kicking off.
Yeah, I'll start with a chart of previous prime ministers and the rate at which they've lost ministers. And it's usually been about a 45 degree angle. Theresa May went pretty vertical but then trailed off towards the end. So she survived her first vote of no confidence. And it took about 6 months for her to finally leave. Mm. But Johnson has gone seriously vertical. And that's a measure of how incredibly distrusted and unpopular he is throughout his parliamentary party. One of the problems is he had a big majority at the last election, 80 MPs, and he never bothered to sort of embrace them and bring them in. And sort of work with them. So he's been very standoffish from them. And classically, you know, for all the huge problems and mistakes somebody causes, it's one particular thing that knocks them over. And it's the way he's lied, not that he hasn't lied about so much else before, about what he knew or didn't know about Pincher, the deputy whip, when he was appointed, about his admitting to groping people. So that's the level of distrust. Now, the last reports I've been reading, he's saying that he's not going to go, which is very interesting because that's a testament to his obstinate character. But the party can eject him. Then, and I think that that's going to happen, you know, in the next 48 hours at the latest. But then what happens is quite fascinating, because normally ousted prime minister agrees to stay while a replacement is found. Normally, with the Tory party process, that would take about 6 weeks. But he's so unpopular that he might not be given that role to do, in which case an interim would have to be appointed. It should be the Deputy Prime Minister, Dominic Raab, but he's the Justice Secretary and would consider himself a candidate for Prime Minister. So he wouldn't be able to do the job as interim. And so they'd have to find somebody else. But the most intriguing thing of all is Johnson is threatening to go to the Queen and ask her to prorogue Parliament and call a new election.
Far out.
Yeah, no, this really gets really interesting, because I don't remember this ever happening with a prime minister during her long reign before. So what happens then is quite fascinating, because it's her judgment. And if she judges that the party still has the support of the people and there is a viable alternative to Johnson as prime minister, she can refuse that request. And apparently Buckingham Palace is sort of dusting off the books, getting good advice on whether should Johnson ask for Parliament to be dissolved, whether she might say no. And so, you know, this late in her career, her long reign, there might yet be something of, I can't call it a constitutional crisis, because the Constitution is very clear in this.
Yes.
But that this would be a measure of how sort of unprecedented Johnson's behaviour is.
I mean, this is fascinating. I think I saw he was referred to by a Tory MP yesterday as Rasputin. He's been, you know, killed many times over politically, and then he's still here, but not for much longer. I'm really fascinated in what you think might happen if Parliament was dissolved, if this did go to an election. What do you think could be happening down the pipeline there?
Well, the pundits are saying, the experienced political commentators are saying it would be a pretty much of a bloodbath for the Conservatives. It would be, even if they had a strong new leader, as they would have in time for an election, this has generated so much ill will among and distrust amongst the public at large. It would wash over into the party as a whole. So I haven't seen any reason to opinion polls, and you need to have some very recent ones because this has moved so fast. I think the Conservatives would lose a lot of seats, a great number. They would have to lose 80 over the last election, and I don't know whether quite that would happen. But in the most recent two by-elections, Labour lost two. The Tories lost two incredibly conservative seats, and so that's a measure of how even diehard Tories are fed up with him. Having said that, of course, when it gets to a general election, people are more likely to vote their normal allegiance rather than send a protest vote as they might in a by-election.
What do you make of, I guess, the response to the railway workers' strike that's been happening in the UK? Because this has kind of been an interesting litmus test, perhaps, for the way the public is moving in terms of, like, moving away from maybe a more conservative position, or perhaps it's showing a more frustrated view of what's going on there. Have you had any sort of thoughts around what we've seen in terms of this huge railway workers' strike that's been going on, and the public and media response to that?
Yes, I think the best thing the train workers have going for them is their leader, who's remarkably articulate and has been quite extraordinarily clear at sheeting home responsibility. And so he's saying that, the government's bailed out all sorts of industries, people have, and companies have benefited for billions of dollars worth of contracts through COVID, which were let to them, given to them without due process, and lots of money has been wasted. The pay of rail workers has seriously stagnated. So there's actually a lot of public support for them as workers in the position that they argue the government has put them in. And so whereas normally you would expect a very large degree of public unhappiness, this is, I think, a sort of a sense of solidarity with the rail workers, that the government has treated them very badly, and therefore there is a great deal more support than usual. But this is now the most serious disruption of rail in more than 30 years. I mean, it's again, like so many things under Johnson, you end up using the word unprecedented till it seems to lose all its value.
Yes, absolutely. I did want to touch briefly on some more UK, New Zealand related things. Of course, we've just seen the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, over in the UK brokering some trade deals. Any sort of big takeaways for you from this? Is it a positive action that you've seen happen? Is it sort of live up to the expectations of this trip?
Yeah, the two big things, obviously, was her meeting with NATO. Very important, because this is such a fundamental turning point in international relations, and very important that she was there and be able to have conversations with a wide number of political leaders from other countries. And that would does an awful lot to help bring New Zealand more to people's minds, but also crucially establish those relationships. So I think that meeting was very worthwhile. And she's had a lot of other meetings on the sides, bilaterals with various senior politicians. Then the other one, of course, was in Europe. It's very unusual for the political leader of a country, the prime minister or the president, to get very directly involved in trade negotiations.
Yeah.
But our free trade agreement negotiations with the EU had 2 years of preliminary work and then 4 years of negotiations. And she got involved in the last few days rather than just leaving it to our very, very capable negotiator, who's actually done a good job on this. I heard him speak at a conference yesterday in Auckland, and he was very vague on this, but I sensed that from his comments that her presence directly involved in the negotiations had made a difference in those last few days.
Yep.
Now, the dairy and meat sectors are very unhappy that they haven't got greater access to the EU, but they're completely whistling Dixie. You know, it is very clear that the EU is an incredibly closed market, particularly in those two sectors. And we've been banging our head on that brick wall for five decades or so. So they, the meat and dairy industry actually did get some useful things out of those negotiations, but not the free access they were expecting to get. And of course, lots of frustration there. But there was an awful lot more in the overall trade negotiation, which is very important. So once this is ratified, and that's still not a given process, it's complicated in Europe. Once it's ratified, some 91% of all our trade initially, and I think it gets up to about 94 or 97%, would be free of all kinds of tariffs. And all elsewhere across the primary sector, kiwi fruit and other areas do get some very good benefits. But it's a big benefit across the whole economy. And it now pushes the percentage of all our trade, which is under free trade agreements, from about 50%, as memory serves, round about 5 years ago, 2017, to about 75%. And in these very, very difficult times, the more trade we can get covered by free trade agreements, the better. And so this EU deal is an important step forward. It was very hard to negotiate. I think our negotiators did a very good job. But it looks as though Ardern played a useful role by being an articulate political leader in there at the last.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Rod Oram. It's always great to have you on the show. We'll be glued to the news coming out of the UK for the next wee while, as I'm sure you will be as well. Yeah. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Thanks, Rachel. See you.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.